Look at this. I got headphones on. I got a mic going. Baby.
If
Huh?
only people could see you now.
Hey, no video. We've gone through this before. No video.
Welcome to This Commerce Life. This is a podcast aimed at small, medium entrepreneurs focused on commerce. I'm Phil, your host, and Kenny, your co-host, will join us as well. And we're going to talk to you about the world of retail and commerce and how things are changing in the world.
The guy I work with phones me. We're supposed to be on a phone call. I'm thinking, holy shit, what time is it? 10 o'clock. And then I see your notice comes up. I got to be on two calls right now. And I'm late for both of them. Oh, my God. So I'm running on South African time. How's that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or Italian time, same. It's all good.
Yeah, African time, Italian time, it's all the same.
Same. We'll get there sometime today. It's coming.
Yeah.
Anyway, My apologies.
No problem.
I didn't mean to do that to you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Yeah. So, I've resorted to calling Fats, but that's not Fats's real name, right? Like, that's the name everyone calls you otherwise.
It is. So my mom and dad call me Fats. So call me Nhlanhla. That's my real name. But it's quite a mouthful. Even in South Africa, quite a few people struggle to pronounce my name. My wife is American. She also kind of struggles to pronounce my name. And Fats just comes from me being a fat kid. Luckily, I've lost the weight in my later life, but I was a fat kid growing up.
It's not one of those nicknames that you really want to stick, but it's okay because you're definitely not overweight. So it's maybe...
Yeah.
I don't know. I know it's some of those nicknames that should never have started.
Yep. Absolutely. I also see it as insurance for later in life, just in case I do get fat again. At least I've adopted the name, I've embraced it. So I can just grow into it.
Okay. Well, you got a good attitude, I guess. So that's okay.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So for the audience, we've got Fats on. I'm going to let him introduce himself. I heard you on Taz Latifi's Petropolis podcast, and you've got quite the dynamic business. So we just thought it'd be cool to have you on to one talk about the business and kind of learn a lot about the business that you have and about you. So we're glad you're on. So
a little bit of an international play.
Yeah.
It's kind of
cool,
right?
Yeah. We got Toronto and Vancouver, which is normal, and then we've got Fats in South Africa. Are you in South Africa right now?
I am. Normally I'd be straddling between the US and South Africa, but because of COVID, I'm squarely in South Africa for this year.
Your wife's with you in South Africa, or did you guys get lost in two different continents?
Luckily, we were stranded in the same country.
Thank God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's American. She's from Boston. We met in England, of all places. And then lived in Boston for 2 years together.
Nice.
But she knew all along that I wanted to come back to South Africa. So we've been here since 2010.
Nice.
And she was with me for a big part of the year last year. Ironically, we were actually in New York in February, probably 3 weeks before the major outbreak of COVID. But we made it back to South Africa before things got really crazy.
Well, lucky that you got to get, lucky you were able to do it together. And like, you know, I mean, getting stuck in the States, I guess, wouldn't be that bad either. But
yeah.
I mean, away from all that gong show, it's probably kind of nice to be just in South Africa.
Yeah,
it is. It's not so often that Africans look at the US and they're happy that they're in Africa. But
there's not a lot of times when anybody looks at the US and says, I wish we'd be anywhere else.
Yep. So I love New York. I spent a lot of time there, but it's the city's been through a lot this year and the US more broadly, but
hopefully
it's just going to get better here.
Yeah. Ah, what are you going to do, right?
It's awesome. So Fast, do you mind just telling the audience a little bit about you and the business you run?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a pretty unlikely entrepreneur. I grew up all my life resenting entrepreneurship because my dad was an entrepreneur and I saw how much he struggled to make ends meet with his business. His business was a small mom and pop shop in one of the local neighborhoods here in Johannesburg. And I went to college and did computer science in my undergrad and then worked for McKinsey & Company as a consultant, which was perfect for me. Like, I really wanted to be a suit. So being a management consultant for one of the big consultancies was just great.
Yeah.
And did that for 4 years. And split that experience with two master's programs. And that's when I went to the UK. I went to Oxford to go and do my MPhil in development studies. And then I went to Boston to go and do my MBA out there. But the time that I spent abroad, that's when I probably made the shift or the transition to think about entrepreneurship for a few reasons, which we can chat about. Started my business or left McKinsey in 2015 with no clear idea of what I wanted to do, just with a broad thesis that one, I wanted to get into entrepreneurship. Secondly, I wanted to create jobs in South Africa. Thirdly, I wanted to export unique African products to the rest of the world, and I want to have fun. So that was my mandate when I left. And then I happened to start a pet food factory.
Pet food factory.
Yes.
So you went from McKinsey to just, I'm bored, you know, I want to do something fun, so I'm going to go buy a pet food factory.
It's pretty crazy. So, wow. I mean, I went from staying in five-star hotels and talking to CEOs to working in a small little rented kitchen, coming up with dog food and cat food formulations. And how that actually happened is, initially I was trying to export South African meats to North America and to Europe. I don't know if you've ever, I doubt you would have, but South Africa is some of the best meats in the world. I know I'm partial, but I really do believe that.
I don't know.
Our beef and our steaks, our lamb, our ostrich, our venison, it's all really wholesome, tasty, juicy meats. And none of it is, or very little of it is exported. But the food market for humans is really, really regulated and very competitive and also political. So after trying to get around the USDA's requirements for about a 6 to 7 month period, I started chatting to a friend who was in the pet food industry in the US, and he started sharing some numbers about how rapidly the pet food industry is growing, how sophisticated it's becoming, how humanization is becoming a new trend in that space. So I thought to myself, well, I've got these proteins and these relationships here in South Africa that I've been working on for the past 7 months. And there's this massive growing market internationally, which is the pet markets, pet food and pet treat markets. So why don't I just segue a little bit from looking at meat for humans and try and make those meat products into snacks and foods for dogs and cats. So that's when I made the pivots in late 2015 to shift from food market for humans to the animal markets.
See, now you explained it that way, it's a little more logical. That sort of does make sense because it's a lot easier. Even in Canada, because we're all the same. You guys protect your protein markets no different than the States does, Canada does, Argentina, absolutely. Australia. I mean, we all want to export, but we don't want to import, which makes it really difficult to do business with each other if you don't want to play in each other's fields, right?
Exactly.
But with the animal side, and good for you, because the North American market, like Phil definitively knows even more than I do, is that, I mean, you want to talk about an explosion of just people wanting to give their pets the best they possibly can and high quality protein. I mean, that's a really solid pivot. Good for you. I mean, that's most people would just give up.
Yeah. Right? I'm glad I made that connection. And when I started reading more and more about the pets industry, it just blew my mind more and more. So the America, I think in the last decade now has more families with pets versus families with children. The average spending per pound is greater on pet food and pet treats than it is on human food. And the demand for premium, really nuanced products far outweighs the availability of those products, because a lot of people are still kind of mom and pop operations or legacy businesses.
Yeah.
So it's a really exciting space, and it's been growing at like 7 to 12% over the last 10 years, which is pretty hard to beat.
Crazy. It's crazy. So,
I mean, that's a great spot to be in.
I was thinking about this podcast and I was giggling to myself a little. We, two episodes ago, we had this guy on who built a hemp business from scratch, didn't know any better and took on the FDA to get it done. You know, and then last week we had the guy from, Mexico who, you know, like he WhatsApps with customers. He's the CEO of Bed Bath & Beyond Mexico, and he WhatsApps with customers to get them to buy things. And so, you know, when you're telling the story of like, I went from consulting and then went into like buying a pet factory, like they're kind of like these amazing stories of people who pivot and just don't know, you know, like
don't know enough to not make the decision to go into. Like, if you were actually, I don't take this wrong. If you were smarter and knew more, you never would have done it. It's typically what all of us do, right? Because if we had any brains in our head, we would never do the things we do.
It's absolutely insane. So, I mean, I'm only 3-4 years into my entrepreneurship journey, but I reflect on that first chapter, and it's kind of crazy the things that I was emboldened to do. Coming up with formulations for dogs and cats, what do I know about that? And also formulations that would meet USDA requirements, that would meet all the regulatory requirements, labeling requirements. That's number one.
Yeah.
Secondly, South Africa and Africa never exported food or pet food products outside of Africa. So I had to work with the USDA and the Department of Agriculture in South Africa to come up with those documents for exports of this product from South Africa to the US. Had I known that from the onset, I would have definitely never embarked on this journey, but I'm glad I did, because once you find yourself at that juncture, you have to find a way to make it work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let me ask you something about South Africa, because I'm just curious. I mean, we know now how you got sort of where you got, but pets a big deal in South Africa, or not like, as bad as North America, like where, you know, 60% or 70% of the homes have them. And
so South Africa is, I know Phil's been to Mexico. South Africa is very similar to Mexico and also very similar to Brazil. It's two economies in one country. So 10 to 20% of the population is uber wealthy and lives in cities and neighborhoods that look exactly like the US.
Right.
And in my later life, I'm one of those people. And then the other 70 to 80% of the population lives in relative poverty. It's a developing country. So for the top 20%, they absolutely adore their pets. They spend as much on their pets as anyone else in Europe and in North America. And then the other 70% primarily see pets as functional
livestock.
They need to do something.
Yeah.
Catch mice, scare people away, whatever, whatever it is.
Pretty much that. So it's not a companion. It's a guard dog.
Right.
Which makes sense. It a little bit more interesting, Phil, if you think about it. You're sitting in your kitchen trying to develop foods.
It's complicated.
It's complicated, especially if it's not so widespread. Where in North America, like, pet ownership is obviously very large. I mean, we're lucky. We by birth, we ended up in pretty good spots. I mean, Canada's not a bad place to be born and raised.
Yeah.
Right? Relative to a lot of other places on the planet. Yeah. I mean, so...
Absolutely. And it cuts both ways. So if I was in Canada, I think it would have been easier for me to get to break even and just have those early milestones, just because there's a bigger population that has more of them have pets, more disposable income, greater retail infrastructure in comparison to South Africa. So the ease of doing business is far greater in spaces like that. But on the flip side, in countries like South Africa, there aren't as many graduates who are willing to take on an entrepreneurial venture. So the competition is a little bit less than it would be elsewhere. Had I started this business in North America and Europe, I think within 6 to 12 months, there would have been 3 or 4 Me Too's who maybe would have had more funding and eclipsed my business, versus in South Africa, you've got a 3 to 5 year head start before people start realizing that it might be an opportunity.
Right. And at that point, you're in a really good spot, because you guys can grow the industry almost together. You don't have to work together, but it's a whole different play. Where here, you're just basically trying to figure out who you're going to knock off.
Exactly.
Like, who's going to drop off the edge of the world and so that you can take their share. Like, you have a chance to actually grow. Yeah. That's really cool.
It
also just speaks to you how globally connected the world is. Had I started this business 30 years ago, it would have been so difficult for me to get to this point within 3 years. So the US is our biggest market, but the factory here in South Africa exports to 10 countries around the world on 4 different continents. And in winning over customers, we typically just like email them. We have Zoom calls. We send them samples. You send them samples via UPS. They arrive within a week or two. So you can broker a deal or find a partner in a foreign market within 3 to 4 months. That just would not have happened 15, 20 years ago. You would have necessarily had to go to an international trade show. Those trade shows would have been every 2 years. Email and phone calls would have been a lot slower than they are today. So we can't take for granted how lucky we are to have globalization and technology at our fingertips to make all of this possible.
Well, it makes the world a lot, it's a more even playing field. I mean, the fact, literally, I'm in Vancouver, Phil's in Toronto, you're in South Africa, you're in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. I mean, and yet you can talk, you know, you can see each other. I can see what you look like. I can see what you're thinking. You know, I may not get all the nuances, but we can do a deal because I can say, ah, the guy looks honest. You know what I mean? Like all those things that you can't do on a phone or an email. So, I mean, technology has definitively helped that side of it for sure.
I think, you know, even 10 years ago.
Oh, five years ago, even, Phil. My God, seriously.
You know, five, it was challenging, but you could do it. 10, you couldn't.
10, forget it. You know, I mean, 5 years ago, we wouldn't have done this.
Yeah.
Like videos. I mean, if it wasn't for COVID, I still don't know if we'd be doing this.
Yeah.
This is normal life now. It's only been 9 months. It feels like it's been forever.
No, but I think tech companies have been using this stuff for...
I know, but
you know what I mean? Like, so it would have caught up, but I'm just... Yeah, you're right, though. Like,
3-4 years?
You know... Yeah.
Wasn't going to happen it wouldn't happen this year. This is literally
without COVID, you're right. It wouldn't have been this year.
We could have got here for sure because this is a very... efficient way to talk.
Yeah.
You know, fast doesn't have to get on a plane. We don't have to get on planes. You're in real time. You know, you can see each other.
Yeah.
It's pretty slick, right? Yeah. Which has got to be good for you guys too. I mean, when you're in a more of a, I never want to make it sound offensive, like a developing country, which South Africa is different than a lot of Africa. I mean, South Africa is developed in many respects, but when you're in those places, this has to be like a godsend. Like to what you were saying, like where you can actually do stuff now, be seen, be heard, and like do some cool business.
Absolutely. And the Johannesburg is very similar to, I'd say, Atlanta and LA. It's most similar to the cities in the US, and also similar in size to Atlanta. There's connectivity, mobility, flights.
Cosmopolitan,
everything you name it, it just feels and looks like that. So that's not too difficult. What has been difficult for me in the past is the lengthy travel from Johannesburg to the US. It's an 18 to 20 hour flight from Johannesburg to New York, and New York is just on the East Coast. So if I'm going to the West Coast, I really lose two days, and also 14 hours to Europe. So as much as I hate living like a hermit because of COVID, I am kind of grateful that I can still get as much done in terms of business or from the comfort of my home, as opposed to being at airports 20% of the year.
I did a tiny bit of business for J&J in Johannesburg way back in the, 2010, 2011-ish. But I remember going to the UK first, and then they were like, oh, we've got this thing in Johannesburg. Do you want to go? And I went, yeah, of course I'm going to go. Right. But, you know, when I got on the plane, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be on the plane for how long? And then I went up having to do that leg, I think, three times. So by the time I was done with it, I was like, no, I'll call. My email or calling?
Or I'm going for a month.
Like that, right? Like,
I'm not going for a couple of days, right?
Yeah. Man. Let's talk about, so Minelli Pets, right? Do I have that right? Minelli Pets. And you've got like a ton of stuff here. So you sell in a whole bunch of places. US is your biggest market?
It is. So for my sons, I've actually started two businesses in the last 3 years. The one is the factory in Johannesburg, which exports to various markets around the world, and the US being the biggest market. And the factory exports a mix of private label products or white label products for other international brands.
Yeah.
And we also have two of our own brands. Our hallmark brand is called Nandi. And for Nandi, I've set up a different business in the US that has the sole distribution rights for Nandi going into the US. The US is a very competitive market. So the reason I felt confident about going into the US market is because we focus specifically on unique free range proteins from Africa, like ostrich, venison, warthog, rabbits. And aside from those proteins being different and sounding sexy, they're actually nutritionally superior because these animals are eating natural diets out in the wild, and they're free from stress. And also the way that we harvest them is a lot more sustainable and humane than what happens in your feedlots for beef, for chicken, for lamb. It's just a harvesting that happens, or culling that happens every year to maintain a balance between fauna and flora. So which the brand that we brought to the US is unique proteins that are sustainably sourced and also uniquely African. There isn't any other brand that I know of in the US retail space that's from my part of the world. So that's the US business, and that's typically what I'm working on when I'm in the US, and also why it's easy for me to get on a call with you at this time, because I work South African hours and US hours, mm-hmm. versus the factory in South Africa, which is a nuts and bolts 50-person factory that produces for the rest of the world.
You're I'm a content sort of guy, and I'm looking at Nandy, and your Nandy stuff is kind of funny. Like it's really quirky. Sorry, it's just a weird observation, but like, so Kenny, what I'm talking about.
Okay, what's the webpage?
So if you go to Nandy Pet, so NANDIPETS.
Hang on. A-N-A.
No. NANDI Pets. Yeah. .com. So like under the beef.
So can I.
Well, yeah. No, because the beef pizzle chews, the lead sentences. Did you know that cattle tend to face either magnetic north or south when grazing or resting, regardless of the sun's position or the wind's direction? Why do that? It's a mystery. It's nothing to do with why your dog will love the treat, but it's amazing. It made me read the entire.
I kind of like that. That's kind of an interesting tidbit of.
Dude, I love
Cliff
it.
Cliff Clavin information, something you can talk about when you're at a party.
It's hilarious. Yeah,
absolutely. Just like random factoids.
Oh, exactly. As a party trick.
Yeah.
Why not, right? Wow.
So at the moment, we've got 10 different proteins or 9 different proteins and 4 different product categories. We haven't launched all the proteins, and just would be too many SKUs, but the 5 we have launched are ostrich, venison, Kalahari lamb, which is a free-range type of lamb from here, Nguni beef, also an indigenous type of beef, and Cape fish. And for all those products, we've tried to weave stories about those proteins as on the back of the packs. So each pack and this 24 SKUs that we have at the moment have a very specific story that's either factual about the protein and the part of the world that it comes from, or just quirky and funny.
I think that's pretty cool though.
Yeah, the branding.
I'm liking the reading, right? That's very interesting. So do you source everything from South Africa, or are you sourcing from Africa or predominantly from your own country?
Primarily from South Africa, good question. But our neighboring countries also have some fantastic proteins. So we get some of our beef from Botswana, and Botswana actually exports some of its beef to the US and to Europe. We get some of our fish from Lesotho, which is a landlocked country within South Africa. So it's Southern Africa, but I'd say 90% of the proteins actually come from South Africa.
From the country of South Africa, okay. And in terms of stability of supply chain, from your own country, South Africa is obviously very stable. It's been very stable for the last many years.
Yeah.
But your neighboring friends can be up and down and dicey at times. So how does that impact your supply chain? I mean, I know because 90% is obviously from your own country, but I'm assuming a lot of stuff borders and you know, animals don't necessarily follow geographical lines and, you know, and lines can change, unfortunately, too.
Absolutely. So our suppliers and our supply base is pretty stable. These are all farming families and co-ops that have been around for over 100 years. And in the past, South Africa was an isolated country because of apartheid. It had trade restrictions. So it had to become food secure. And those farmers have become really, really sophisticated. So we're a net exporter of most of our food products. And so I'm leveraging hundreds of years of farming experience and exporting experience with the suppliers that I work with. I'm actually a pretty small part of the overall business because the majority goes to the European market and to the Asian market for hotels and restaurants and so on.
Really?
And the cuts of meat that you buy aren't good enough to make it into a hotel or good enough to make it into a restaurant. So that's not too much of a risk. What is a risk though is animal disease. So there's just, especially with animals that are harvested in the wild, you don't too often have outbreaks of cow disease, mad cow disease, or bird flu in South Africa or in the US, because most of those animals live in a controlled environment and they're pumped with antibiotics and steroids and they're monitored on a daily basis, versus with animals that are out in the wild, they cover vast terrain and they can be infected by any random thing, including geese that are migrating from Europe coming down to South Africa.
Really?
So every 2 or 3 years, there's one of our species that gets affected by some sort of random disease that limits the supply of that specific protein for between 6 to 18 months. So we just can't get that product until the vets in the country get that disease under control. And that's part of the reason that you've got a basket of protein so that you're not too dependent on any one protein.
Right.
But that's the risk, animal disease versus actual supply.
See, so again, because we live in such a sheltered world here, you forget.
We don't have that problem.
We don't have, because we don't have some of these challenges because we just don't have these challenges, right?
Yeah.
And I find it fascinating that out of such a horrific lack of a better public policy on how to run a country, that you do get these benefits that did come from it, were because nobody wanted to talk to you because of how your government managed people, which was brutal. Mm-hmm. But you become self-sustainable. Like you have to learn, say, okay, nobody's talking to us. Nobody wants to trade with us. Shit, we got to eat. How are we going to do this? It's bad to say, because again, we're in a different world, but out of something so bad that something so fundamentally cool sort of comes from it, where, you know, I mean, I don't know if we're self-sustainable, Phil. I think we must, not. I'm sure we import more than we export. So to export more than you're importing of a food source like this is, to me, and you're still feeding your own, is pretty cool. That's, you know, wow.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. The most policies have unintended consequences. They can be good and bad. I think South Africa's food security is an unintended positive consequence of apartheid. Apartheid was deplorable. Oh, horrific.
Yeah.
There were some good things that are still remnant and still evidence in South Africa because of that passage in history.
Yeah. It's just when you said it, I thought it's such a brutal time. Nothing positive, nothing good. And yet something does result that we're, you know, and as a go forward, it's a good thing that a result happened, not that the thing happened, but the result happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's also a beautiful irony in the fact that apartheid was a policy against people of color. I'm a person of color, and I'm leveraging the natural produce from that passage to export to the rest of the world. So the architects of apartheid are probably rolling in their graves. But...
And so they should be. And so they should be.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Oh my gosh. This is cool. So I think the wrinkle of shipping, of exporting, you know, kind of overseas and cross continents is something I'm curious about.
Especially meat products, Phil. There's so many restrictions.
I mean, on a regular, I gotta think on a regular day, it's difficult. Like the COVID stuff, has it impacted your business at all in terms of shipping and supply lines, that kind of thing?
It has. So the pet industry in general has been strong this year, and the pet industry has typically been anti-recessional. So even with the financial crisis the last time around, it wasn't too impacted. If anything, people tend to spend a little bit more on their pets when there's a crisis or a downturn in the economy, because they feel like you're my comfort source. So let me put a little more money and a little comfort into you.
Right.
But that overall gain for the industry doesn't translate into a benefit for everyone within the industry. So for my company with relatively new brands, we definitely have been hit, because people regress to more common known brands when times are tough, especially when they're buying online. So I'd say probably 20% of the trade has shifted from buying in stores to buying online. And when you're buying online, you're not meandering to try and find a unique pet treat or a new type of pet food, which you would do in stores. So that migration to online has actually resulted in a downturn in sales for me. Huh. We were much stronger in the trade because mom and pop shops like the story behind Nandi. They like the story behind these unique proteins. They can tell their customers about it.
Yeah.
Can't really have that conversation, that dialogue online. So our sales have dropped significantly, probably in the region of about 50%. But the positive part is that our store growth has been buoyant and strong. So we've been growing at about 50 to 100 stores per month, even during COVID, which is really encouraging. It just means that people are still interested in these products. Their customers like them, they're buying more and more. It's just that in comparison to what it was in Q4 last year, it's significantly down.
Interesting. So are you finding the brands you're co-packing, your private label, the brands for your retailers and stuff like that, those are growing as people seem to be trusting the retailer more? And so you just moved it from one bucket to the other bucket, in essence, really.
So we've got one retailer brand here in South Africa, and that's been doing really, really well. And the nice thing about private label for retailers is that they'll keep reinvesting in it.
100%.
So that's done well. For our international private label business, it's been a mixed bag, mostly actually a decrease in demand and exports. And that's because of the long cash conversion cycle of exporting. So if a company in Germany or South Korea is buying from us, they'll get the products 40 days after we ship it in their warehouse, and then they need to store it for a few weeks, maybe a few months, and then sell it. So from the time that you get invoiced to the time that you can realize that product into cash becomes a 3 to 4 month cycle. In a normal year, it is a very long time. In a normal year, people are willing to wait that long because the margins are good. But in a year like this, when cash is tight, they just think to themselves, you've got a cool product, but right now cash is king. So I'm just going to focus on products that I can convert into cash very quickly, which are typically local products in those countries.
Right. But that's even hard for you. If you're doing 90 to 100 day term, 120 day terms, that's, you know, you're not a bank. Your job's not to finance retailers. That's a hit.
Yeah.
It is a hit. It absolutely is a hit. It depends on the size of the customer or the retailer that you're dealing with. So obviously the bigger they are, they dictate the terms to us. But if you're dealing with a distributor, especially a medium-sized one, then we'll meet each other halfway so that you both kind of feel in the pain. Yeah. So it's there's no business or product or segment that ticks all the boxes. So in our case, we've got good margins. We've got a defensible product because it only comes from one part of the world.
Right.
We've got a brand that people seem to be liking, but the supply chain that we need to finance is really long. And there isn't any smart way to get around that because flying the stuff across from country to country just doesn't make sense.
No, economically, you're dead before you start that. That's a nightmare. Shipping in general has gone through the roof. Shipping by air is just a disaster.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Like, I thought I was the only person who's
No. Oh, no. Geez, 2-3 years ago, you could get, you could have cans going across from North America to Asia for peanuts. Literally, $1,000 for a 20-foot, $1,500 for 40. Now they're four times that.
It's crazy.
I mean, the rates have gone absolutely mental. And the thing is, I mean, I don't know, unless you're unique, I don't think your costs have stayed low. And you're definitely not a large charge anymore.
Yeah.
So what you get for what you put in is completely different world. Your margins might have been really good 2-3 years ago. They ain't as good as they used to be.
Absolutely. So the lucky part for us is that as a new factory, your efficiencies are, I can't say exponential, but the improvements are pretty significant from year to year. So that's where the cost saving has come from. But that cost saving has been eaten up by all these expenses that you're mentioning. The increase in shipping costs. The longer payment terms that you have to negotiate with our suppliers. So luckily we have been able to save in some parts, but those savings have just been eaten up by other people in the value chain.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. In South Africa. So what's the, in terms of the workforce, is it a large pool? Like, can you get people if you need people? I'll just give you an idea, like in North America right now, mostly because of COVID, obviously, and because I think we're just trying to avoid anarchy in the streets, because heaven forbid someone should miss, you know, a box of French fries a day. Like, we've pumped a lot of money into our economies to make sure people had money so that we wouldn't not have riots. I mean, we've done it to the detriment to some degree of trying to get people. So if I need someone for my coffee bar, for example, mm-hmm. I'll have people come up and say, well, you know what? I make more staying home. So, you know, really, I'm not interested. You're thinking like, shit, I mean, why do you? So is what South Africa in a similar boat?
We don't have quite the same fiscus as the US and Canada do. But so the support to furloughed staff or unemployed people has been a little bit less than what you see in the US. Mm-hmm. But the point of the theme that you are highlighting is true in South Africa, that the majority of government support has gone to workers and going to companies. Right. So we were forced to shut down for 3 months, and the government gave us a bit of money, but all that money had to go to wages. We couldn't use that money to pay arrears or to buy raw material or to invest in R&D. And that was a lot of the feedback that was coming back from businesses that, great, we absolutely understand that you need to try and keep social order in the country, and a big part of the money needs to go to actual wage earners. But businesses themselves need a bit of money to try and get themselves out of this hole. So we've just had to refinance and dig deep to try and make up that gap for the business itself, because most of the funding has gone straight to wage earners.
So it's kind of similar to here. I mean, for small business here, it's been a rough go too. I mean, it's great that you have a rent deferred, but so I go from worrying about paying $3,000 this month to $12,000 in 4 months. If there's no business, what's the difference if you defer it? By the time I start up, I'm in a worse spot than I was before.
Completely.
I don't know what you want me to do. I got no cash flow for months. You're thinking, okay, well, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
Well, you're open. Yeah. You should be able to pay. Well, no, not really.
No, it doesn't work like that.
No. And plus, I got people not paying me. I'm, 120 days out. I mean, I can pay the rent. How about next year sometime, like toward the end of 2021?
Yep. No, it's kind of worrying. The big part of the focus right now is still on public health and getting COVID under arrest. And then also a lot of the tension in the US is around the elections. But next year and the next 3 years are going to be a long journey to try and get the economy back to where it was, especially for small businesses that have been a little bit neglected from the funding programs and the debt forgiveness schemes that the governments have been putting out. I don't in my lifetime remember businesses being affected so wide scale in so many different parts of the world by one issue. This is kind of crazy.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah. This we've had small things, right? Like we've had like SARS, we've had swine flu to very small extents, but this one's
this one's out of control for something we can't even see.
And
the havoc it's causing. I mean, it's also making us better in a lot of spots too. You're learning a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess again, from something horrific, there are learnings you can sort of take out of it, I guess. Doesn't feel that great right now. Maybe in a couple of years we'll look back and think, oh, okay, well.
Do you see your model going more online? Like, do you see yourself drifting digitally? It just feels like, so I guess no crystal ball, right? But I think when we started this, Kenny and I've done a lot of talking about COVID and how it's affected small business. But, you know, we kind of thought that, you know, right about now, we'd be able to recover some of what we'd lost. But I don't know what it's like in South Africa. For us here, we really had like we had a window of maybe 4 to 6 weeks where, you know, the population of the economy felt like it was just starting to pick up again. And what our rates have now spiked. You know, I think in Toronto here, in Toronto the city just released models that they think that we're on an upward spike that won't even peak till we hit February or March of next year. You know, which is a long, it's a long time. If you're a business that didn't have any cash back in March, you maybe gained a couple of weeks back, you know, in late August, right? And then, and now you got to like last till March. I just don't, you know, I don't know how.
But they're talking, so Fats knows, like in Ontario where Phil is.
Yeah.
I mean, their premier is saying no, but there's talk of another shutdown.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, man, we just got started again.
He's fighting the good fight, though.
Like, he is, because I don't think we can do two.
Yeah, I don't think.
I mean, we barely got through one. I don't even think we realize what's happened yet. Because, again, like in Canada, the subsidies are still there.
Yeah.
It weren't working, but you're still getting paid. Like, when those shut down, like, it's going to be not pleasant for a lot of people.
No, it's
absolutely for individuals and for businesses.
Businesses, for sure.
Yeah. But Phil, just coming back to your question about the shift to online.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Online is certainly the future. And I think COVID has fast forwarded the gain and share of e-commerce versus, say, the rate it was growing at in the last decade. What I wouldn't want to do over time is completely abandon my typical trade, my brick and mortar store,
because
those are the guys that got me to where I am right now. We are currently in 600 stores, and those are independent mom and pop shops. We've got very similar businesses to the business that my dad had. So I never at any point in the future say, okay, well, thank you for giving my brand some credibility in the US market. So now I'm going for So I wouldn't do that, but I would get to a point where we've say got 1,500 retailers and say that, okay, that's the base that will work with. They're not going to put any more investment into getting more brick and mortar stores, but everything above that is just going to be through online. With the massive caveats that it wouldn't be at a different price, or even certainly not a lower price than what the product is available in stores. If people are buying it online, it's just purely for convenience, because they're far away from a store. But that's the shift that I'd like to see. And the final point that I make on this is, online seems sexy and easy for a lot of people who just think about it intuitively, but it's actually incredibly difficult. At the end of the day, you're still selling a product that is a promise to a customer. And that promise is far easier conveyed in a store through a conversation with somebody in the store or through word of mouth, as opposed to you spamming people or putting ads on Instagram and Facebook and Google ads. It's still the human connection. So that's the one point. The second point is, I haven't come across any businesses that weren't thinking about e-commerce pre-COVID and then have been able to profitably sell online by investing into over a 3 to 6 month period. It's a long journey. It's a 1, 2, 3 year process before your online spend generates an actual return. So I am investing in it, but I'm seeing it as a 2 to 3 year journey as opposed to a quick fix in light of COVID.
You have, I mean, it's funny because the conversation, we've seen some companies, you know, do the hurry up, But you're right. Like in one of the companies that I'm working with, we were talking about getting them online, but when we got to things that are very like digital metrics, so like cost of acquisition or cost of action, they were surprised to find how expensive it still is. Right, like cost of action, you know, the like stacked up cost of driving someone to your website to acquire still averages like $10 to $15
That's a lot,
you know, for the pet industry, right? Like it's a different way to think of your marketing dollars, but it's definitely a lot of money. And then I think the other part that's challenging for you is that like the shipping cost just gets higher, right? Like when you're, you know, cause right now shipping cost is high because you're shipping a lot of product, you know, the minute you start shipping in small packets, you know, it'll go through the roof, right?
No, the shipping could be 2 times the actual product
cost. Seriously,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, and it's Kenny. It's funny you mentioned that because for 2 months I ran an online promotion on Facebook and Instagram, giving away products for free. So your first purchase is completely free for the product. All you need to pay for is the shipping, and our website can calculate what the shipping is going to be. By USPS, by the way, so it's a cheaper shipping method than UPS.
Cheapest solution.
Yes, exactly. But still, the cost of shipping was a hurdle for people to get a free product. So they were well, I understand that your product is $8, $9, and I'm getting that for free, but I'm not that cool with paying $5, $6 for shipping. So, and that's something that I couldn't subsidize. Yeah, so absolutely right that shipping costs are a hurdle when you're shipping small items.
I think even the bonus, and maybe Phil, like if you think about the industry that Fats is in, is people didn't stop buying for their pets. Mm-hmm. People didn't stop going to the pet store. Mm-hmm. They might've stopped going to a lot of other places. Like we've talked about it. Cause Fats, we do a lot of stuff in the natural health space in like human side, whether supplements or food, et cetera. And what happened in Canada with COVID is the trend was obviously over many years to go more boutique, and people wanted the cool experience and they wanted to talk and the big mass stores were the devil and all that stuff, right? COVID hits. Nobody wants to go to small stores because you want to limit your trips. You want to go just to one-stop shop. So, you know, that's how that side went. But I think on the pet side, it's been much more insulated where, you know, people won't take a risk to go to any store because they don't want to get sick unless the pet needs something, then they'll go to wherever store they need to go to make sure the pet's taken care of. So I think even in your industry, you may have time just built into rushing into online, because I think bricks and mortar is, I don't know what the stats are, Phil. I don't know if you've seen them or not. I'm assuming the stats for bricks and mortar pet is still pretty solid relative to clothing, books, all these other categories where you've got time, because people still like to, you know, hey, Phil, what's good for my pet? What should I, you know, I think people still like that. That conversation
you can't replace.
It's tough to do, right?
I didn't realize that. Realize this until I got into the industry, but I think that the same emotional investment that people have with children and babies is translated into pets.
Yeah, 100%.
And it plays out in their willingness to pay three times, four times on pet food and pet treats in comparison to themselves. Like, why not just buy your dog the same steak that you bought yourself at dinner? It's cheaper than
cheaper.
To your point about your willingness to still go into stores, because you park your rationality when it comes to your pets, because this is something that you love. You invest in all your time and emotion, because in return, it also gives you unconditional love and support. So you definitely write that there's more latitude and more consistency in the pets industry than in many other industries right now.
I think so.
Yeah. I think the other part that's really interesting is, you know, when you, I don't know, I'm like this, and I know a bunch of dog owners that are like this, where you look at some of the, like, what's really cool, like you're like the Nandy stuff. I look at it and go, okay, if I want ostrich for me, it costs me a shit ton of money to get ostrich. Either it's impossible or
it's so expensive.
It'd be really expensive. Yeah. But I can buy an ostrich bag of chews for my dog for like $10, right? Like, I'm doing that because I can't have it. Why not the dog? It's awesome, right? Like, wild boar, bring it on, right? Like, you know, I'd love to have that. So there's like, there's some really neat kind of buying behaviors there that, kind of.
It's just got a cool product lens to it, right? Like,
yeah.
I like your site. I just like looking at it because Zulu chicken, like Savannah rabbit. Like, I'm thinking the same thing.
It's fantastic.
I mean, forget the pet stuff. Man. Like, you should be sending some of the real stuff over.
You know, fast. The only issue I have with Nandy is there's no Canadian flag on the end of the shipping there.
Oh, damn.
Because I got to tell you, on my card, I've got 8 things in my card. I'm like, no, it doesn't ship here. So, I'm just giving it more time.
If the Canadian authorities are listening to this podcast, please process our paperwork. We've been trying to get into Canada for the past 2 years.
But come on, Health Canada.
We're the only South African company that's trying to get into Canada, so I'm guessing we're at the bottom of the list. But it's kind of crazy that we were able to get into the US within 3 months of our application, and Canada's taken over 2 years. But I'm still hopeful that one day our products will be in Canada.
You will get it in. Canada had some different issues, just so you're aware. Like, we had some pretty widespread pet scares, I'm going to say 4 to 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And it clamped the government down. So honestly, it to what you were saying before, it's easier to get meat products into Canada for human consumption right now probably than pet consumption. Canada, the states is always willy-nilly. The states always sounds like they're tough about restrictions. Mm-hmm. States doesn't care, they just open up the world to everything. Takes a little time. Canada is really restrictive. And it might even be some of the people you're using, maybe there's maybe on a separate send us maybe who you're using to try to do some of your regulatory, and maybe we can even ask around. Maybe there's someone who's a little more well-connected than the person you're using. Yeah. Maybe there's no help we can give you, but you never know. Maybe that sometimes that does have a play.
There's definitely a formula, like with Health Canada, there's a bit of a formula. So the problem is when you misstep with them, it's a big misstep, right? Like not to suggest that you have, but sometimes what happens is they, you misstep and then that's it. You know,
you're
like
flagged.
You're flagged. And there's no way around it. And it just takes a whole lot longer. But definitely. Yeah.
But the pet industry, to Kenny's points, is actually more related than the human food industry. So the certificates and the orders that you have as a pet facility are far more stringent than what someone else who's making sausages or making hamburger patties is, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it is what it is. What it does mean, though, is that especially for newer facilities and plants, those really are some of the best food facilities around the world. They are spotlessly clean.
Yeah.
We built a factory from scratch in 2017. It's cleaner than my house. It's cleaner than my own kitchen because we have to keep records every day of the bacterial counts, the microbial counts, and everything like that.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting, this inversion of priorities between animal health and human health.
It's crazy. I think the world's gone mental. I think we've all gone nuts.
It's 2020. The world has gone mental.
I think it actually did.
Yeah, the whole thing's...
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. Fats, thank you so much.
What a fascinating story. I'm so happy you came on. That's what a cool story.
Yeah, we're really
glad. Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah.
Oh, it was really cool.
If people want to find you, what's the best place to find you?
So our website has got a lot of information about our brand. Okay. That's nandypets.com. Our products are also available on Amazon and Chewy, but most importantly, we're available in a whole bunch of brick and mortar stores, small mom and pop businesses. Please support them if you see our products out there. And yeah, that's where you can find our products.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. This was amazing. We're so glad
you made it. What a great story. Yeah.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Very cool.
All right.
It's still early days, but yeah, I'm still enjoying the ride.
Oh, it's all good, man. You're still smiling. Amazing. That's half the battle.
You're doing great. It's amazing. All right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Super. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you. Still, Phil, stay on for a minute. We'll chat a little bit.
Yeah,
thanks, Fats. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
Ciao. How cool is that, eh?
Yeah. Cool, right?
And then
I was having a bit of a giggle because he was just like, I quit consulting, started a business. I was like, oh my God.
I love entrepreneurs do that, right? I love it. And what's nice too is because, I mean, typically we are so ignorant to Africa in general, especially probably most of the world. I don't think really, unless you're from Africa, unfortunately, it seems to be the lost continent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just cool to see neat stuff happen around the planet.
Yeah.
Because we do, we get so egocentric in this country, in North America. Like we forget that there's a world, a much larger world outside of our boundaries that's doing really neat things.
Yeah, that you know that continent, I think is just going to become more and more prominent, right? So I think it's just really cool. Like I think I know very very little about Africa. Like all the other ones, you know, you learn chunks along the way, but that one was. That one's, you know, just unknown really, right? So
well, it's because it's so interesting. None of us, like if you look at where the power play and the money's come from a North American standpoint, what do we know most of? Europe, because most of us originally were from Europe.
Yeah.
And now Asia, because the next generation is mostly Asian.
Yeah.
That's sort of your makeup of Canada, right? So why would we don't learn anything really about South America, Africa definitively. I mean,
I
thought that was really cool. I'm really surprised that I didn't realize they were so self-sustainable with food source.
Right. I know. It's so cool.
I thought that was pretty fascinating. And he's got some cool shit, man. Like Kalahari lamb sounds really, forget that for the pet. Like Kalahari lamb sounds
But I'm telling
really
you, right?
Good.
Like my eye goes to all of those things right away is like anything that, you know, I can't acquire here to eat for me, right? Like, so Sophie does. She has wild boar.
Well, why not?
Has, you know, like, because that shit's cool, man. Like,
exactly.
You can't eat it. So, you know, why not you, right? So I love it.
I think that's pretty slick, man. Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
All right. That's the end of this Commerce Life. We'll be back soon with the next episode. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it. Give us feedback. Tell us what you think. Subscribe. Like us, join us, share us, tell your friends about us. And we hope to see you next time with more commerce news.